Welcome to the Women in Jazz Media podcast series On the Bookcase, with music from Hannah Horton. Hello and welcome to Women in Jazz Media's podcast series On the Bookcase, where we talk to and explore incredible female authors, and I'm absolutely thrilled to welcome the fantastic Judith Tick. Judith, welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
It's such a pleasure to talk to an English audience because Ella had such a large fan base in England, and it's important to me to reach them.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say, and we've had your book on our bookcase. And forgive me, because with my Jazz Journalists Association hat on, I got the book before it was published. So I've had it longer than most people. So when was it actually launched? Was it December it actually came out to the wider public?
Yes, it was December 5th.
Fantastic.
And that was the big day.
Yes. Oh,
it was wonderful.
Oh, and honestly, I mean, Ella, We could talk and will talk about Ella, but firstly, because this is about authors, you happen to have written about Ella, but I'd love to find out a little bit more about you, because I did a bit of research and there's very short biographies about you out there. So please share with the audience a little bit about you, your work, and ultimately what brought you to Ella.
Well, and I am an academic author in a certain way, because the book came out of my work as a college professor teaching music history to all kinds of students at Northeastern University. But even before that, I was teaching at Brooklyn College, and I got in New York, and I got interested in biography there. Actually, the interest in biography came out of second wave feminism, which had a huge cultural and intellectual impact in the 1970s. And I remember reading important biographies of Alice James, the lesser known sister of Henry, and a fantastic one about Oscar Wilde by Richard Ellman, and then Martin Duberman's Paul Robeson. And my own interest began with linking music and biography through Charles Ives, who's a very autobiographical composer. So I wrote a biography about Ruth Crawford Seeger, who was a modernist and whose daughter, Peggy Seeger, is very well known in England for her folk songs and her own creative work. And I immersed myself in the Seeger family for many years, and that book took a long time. The Ella Fitzgerald project began somewhat sideways. I had already written one, and I'd written books in between. And I came to this project really at the end of my teaching career and had compiled a list of sources about American music. I was very aware of the contributions of African American female musicians. You'd have to be deaf as a musicologist not to have heard Bessie Smith. And I grew up with Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday, of course, and Sarah Vaughan. But Ella Fitzgerald was a special case because she was important in my own development through the songbooks. And when I came to write about her, I knew I was writing about a famous person. And that was very different from writing about Ruth Crawford Seeger. And I knew that would be fun. What I did not expect was how much my previous work in feminist scholarship would have an impact on this book. I knew I had a lot of work to do as a white woman to understand what she came up through Jim Crow and through American racism. I had a suspicion that she would have had to have challenged herself with Jane Crow, the other term for sexism. But I didn't know in what ways and how much. And right from the beginning, I got hints from the music that I learned that she was singing. The reception of A Tisket, A Tasket, her first great hit, was so ambivalent. And I read her wonderful manager, Norman Granz, didn't think very much of her own self-perception. Ella was a somewhat modest person. She did not project the diva personality. Quite deliberately, she cultivated a people singer attitude. I think one would say. But when he said she had no absolute She had absolutely no idea of her own importance. That rang a bell in my head. I thought, that can't really be. And I made it my mission to find out as many interviews in which she talked about her craft as possible. I could do that. I do want to ask a question now, because I could go on in very long paragraphs.
No, I love it. And it's funny because you're covering things, or at least eking at things that I was going to ask you. Because I mean, and I have to say to, and everybody listening, if you haven't read this book, it's so glorious. It's wonderful. But I think for me, I mean, Ella, and obviously most people listening to this, in fact, I would question anybody not knowing Ella, but Ella feels like she's kind of part of everyone's lives. I mean, even if you're
Yes.
not a jazz fan, or if you're, Ella's just kind of there. So what's particularly beautiful about your book is, even though Ella, is part of everybody's lives, and so much has been spoken, written about her, you still managed to bring new lights and almost, I don't want to say refreshing. I mean, it is refreshing, but it's kind of, it brings her to light again, but also with kind of hidden insight. And I think, as you were saying, for me, I think that the way you did that in particular was through her songs, those conversations, that dialogue about her relationship with songs. I don't think it's,
Yes.
that in particular, which is obviously a huge part of her career. And also, when we think about a lot of the jazz legends, and in particular the female singers, Ella, I mean, she's a queen, and she's almost an untouchable queen. She's always, her reputation is one of calm, of grace, of which she is all those things. And I love that you bring in some of that hidden stuff that isn't often explored. But as you say, being a black woman at that time, I mean, you can't even imagine, but it's so relevant to her experience. And I think something with, particularly with Ella, it's often discussed with other singers, but I think with Ella sometimes it's not discussed. So I think one of my questions, because I could also talk for ages, is, I mean, did you ever feel overwhelmed by the importance of tackling Ella? I mean, as a subject matter, Ella, I mean, how did you feel about, was there any pressure?
What I felt was the responsibility of doing justice to her genius. As a musicologist, I understood that she delivered so many messages in her improvisations, for example. Some were directed to connoisseurs and the fantastic musicians she worked with. They heard references to other people's improvisations that the ordinary listener couldn't hear. And then there were the references for the amateurs like me, or perhaps you, or perhaps most of our listeners. We get the big references when she gives us lyrics to other songs in the middle of her own improvisation. We get her shout out to a tisket a tasket, or we get her imitations, or really not imitations, but impersonations of Louis Armstrong. That is for everybody. That's for everyone to understand. I soon realized that it would be impossible to transcribe every single improvisation that Ella ever did and identify every single, like, I mean, a part of me wanted to do that.
I
And
bet,
I saw,
yeah.
yes, I did. And I realized it was absolutely ridiculous. I didn't have the chops for it. And there were other people doing little bits and pieces of it out there. And I sought their advice and incorporated their work into the book and gave them credit for the insights they brought to her. So they're in my bibliography, and I wish I could just roll off their names now. And I could, if you want me to go back and look, but I.
No, but I tell you what, who I will mention, because one of my guests not long ago, because we talked about you, was the fantastic Stephanie Stein-Creese, because of course she just released her book about Chick Webb. And so
Yes.
obviously Ella came up, and it was interesting because we talked about how in her book it was kind of the very much the beginning of Ella's career in relationship to
Absolutely.
Chick. But you obviously referenced that, and I'd love to know, because I presume you two know each other, but how did that work? So, as far as learning or kind of embedding Stephanie's work, incorporating it in your work, but without kind of going over the same sort of material. Did you kind of get together and discuss it? How, just from an author, like from a writing point of view, how did that work?
Well, we really met during the pandemic. So there was, and we had, and my work was much farther along than hers at that
Okay.
time. But she, and so I gave her, it was really a mutual relationship of reciprocity. She brought stronger jazz chops to her project than I could bring to mine.
Right.
But I also gave her a feminist perspective that I think helped her separate some of the mythologies around Webb and Ella Fitzgerald so that she could see that this main line of narrative, which was how Ella subverted Chick Webb, could be questioned. And I remember we had long talks about who discovered Ella, how did Chick do it? And there's strong the biographies out there that really take a very firm stand. But I decided to take Ella's words very seriously and follow her advice. Ella became so important to the band at the time when women band singers were treated as ornaments. You know, sing your song and sit down. Choose you a seat and sit down. That's an old line from an African American spiritual. And she was playing in somebody else's backyard. And there was a song that haunted me from her youth when she was excluded from playing with white children in a backyard where her mother worked. And there was a song at the time called Stay in Your Own Backyard. And right through the whole of Ella's career, I feel she surmounted that pressure. So as a band singer, her yard was supposed to be one lyric in the middle of a song. No, she dominated the song, and she be and Chick understood, and he went with her, and she then became part of the band and learned how to improvise. Again, she wasn't staying in her own backyard. Right through her career, we can go. I'm going to riff it right off. Okay,
Go for
ballad singing. Right through the
it.
war, she was given all kinds of ballads to sing, written pretty much for standard Moon June type, and she was singing Duke Ellington and promoting his music as well. Then when she went with Dizzy Gillespie, that was considered extraordinary. Certainly other people had scatted, but she was trying to scat avant-garde melody and avant-garde harmony. And she created these masterpieces through that. And her manager at the time, Mo Gale, thought it was shocking that she was trying to risk her reputation on that. Then with the jazz at the Philharmonic, she developed a fabulous epigrammatic style to give you three brilliant minutes of a Gershwin improvisation. And that led him to understand she could do songbooks. With the songbooks, she was told she wasn't smart enough. Some people thought she wasn't smart enough, if you can imagine.
Which is
She
crazy.
didn't understand Cole Porter's double meanings. She couldn't really relate to a song about a prostitute. It's all the projection of other people's notions of what femininity is. Then in she conquered that milieu, and we should say the songbooks became canons for Black singers in particular, or not just Black singers, but jazz singers. They go back to those songbooks to learn the material the way they think it should sound, or the way it sounded, without the projection of persona on all the material. Quincy Jones thought that at a young singer in the States. Jose Jones told me that. I think it's, and other singers have said that. It's a very important contribution to create a vocal canon that lasts as long as hers has,
Oh, yeah,
through
100.
as a touchstone for a great repertory. I can go on. And with Ellington, she promoted his songs like no other
Yeah. Oh,
jazz
that
singer of the 20th
relationship.
century did, a very powerful relationship. And in the 60s, as she was pioneering along with many others, like Frank Sinatra in particular, jazz pop, he stood up for her when there's a purist strain in jazz
Oh, yeah.
criticism.
Oh, yeah.
There is in every kind of scholarship. It's not just jazz critics who cleave to their boundaries. In fact, we need to praise jazz critics for having the strength to create a discipline around jazz. But nevertheless, they were subject to the same cultural pressures, and they had different, they were obsessed with words, for example. She didn't sound like Billie Holiday. She wasn't as sexually obvious as Billie Holiday. So those were taken as flaws. They emphasized her flaws rather than her virtues more than they should have. And Nat Hentoff in particular, who's a critic I greatly admire, and I had some conversations and we talked about that. Or Gunther Schuller, a brilliant scholar who wrote, 900 pages on the swing era and basically ignored Ella, told me he didn't have room to include her, but he wouldn't bebop her. There were excuses for not being able to grapple not only with the ambiguities around a mixed or hybrid genre like jazz pop, but also larger than life femininity that they weren't prepared to acknowledge that was basically musical. It was hard, yes. Phew, that's a long explanation.
But an
Okay.
important one. But I think, picking up on a few of the things that you said, and in fact, I was reading an interview that you did, and forgive me, I can't remember with who it was, but someone asked you about, you were talking about streaming and how, looking at kind of live performances kind of back in the day with how a lot of people now listen to music through streaming. So they miss some of the richness. Of kind of album artwork and all those kind of things.
Yes,
Y yeah, but and I think and I can't remember your exact comment, but what stuck out for me, you said something beautiful because this is where your book really brings Ella to a new audience, and she absolutely comes across as kind of female empowerment personified. And I think quite often that's not really the way Ella has often been thought. I mean, behind the scenes we know, but I think for a kind of, I'm going to sound old here, but for a younger generation who knows Ella for singing the songbook and kind of singing the jazz standards, I think sometimes people don't understand how incredible she was. For the fighting that she had to do to be able to sing the song she wanted to sing, her relationship with those songs. And as you say, that the boxes that she didn't fit in, and the strength that it took to actually do what she did. I think you've brought that to light for a whole new audience through your book, and that's so important.
Thank you very much. I think one of the ways that that came to me was through streaming on YouTube, when fans in Europe in particular posted tapes of recitals she did in their countries. See, most of the tapings and recitals she did in Europe were not shown in the United States. What we knew about Ella was American television. The material isn't terrible, but it's bland most of the time. I mean, there's some great Frank Sinatra and Ella, and there's some great Duke and Ella. And I don't want to dismiss American television so quickly, but full-length recitals like the one from Berlin in 1968 that mesmerized me are so important, were so important. And I hope readers or listeners listening to this podcast go search that out, because on that recital, she sang a magnificent version of Summertime. She sang Ray Charles's I Can't Stop Loving You in the most autobiographical way. She sang the songbooks as well. She sang Mack the Knife. She owned the stage. She absolutely owned the stage. She talked to the audience in ways that American audiences could not see because she had such a defined slot on American television. And there was the Ella I knew was so influenced by soul and admired Aretha Franklin, listened hard and adored Ray Charles, knew what was going on in Black music, and absolutely embraced it to enliven and spiritualize her own relationship to a new kind of music.
Oh, Yes. Honestly, I'm just imagining. I mean, what was it like? I mean, how long did this book take you? So from when you decided, and say Ella's been part of your life all your life probably, but from when you decided, yeah, do you know what? I'm actually going to write a book, to
Oh my
publishing.
goodness.
How long
Yes.
did that
How long?
take?
Well, it took, I didn't get a real contract. I signed, oh my goodness. Let's start and try to tell the truth simply. It took me a while to feel I could write this book, and I knew I needed a contract. So I got an academic contract first from an editor who really loved my other work. I also wrote to her son, Ray Brown Jr. You see, when you write about somebody like Ella Fitzgerald, lots of people are alive who knew her. Her family is alive. That was true for the Seegers, but they're a very special family in their own right. And in this case, I didn't know her relatives, nor were they outstanding in the music world. I knew of her son, Ray Brown Jr., who was the son of Ray Brown, the genius bass player Ella was married to. And I needed to get his blessing.
Yes, of
So
course.
I wrote to him. I didn't mean that I was going to write an authorized biography, but I needed him to feel that I could do it. I also needed that reassurance from my Black musicology friends also that I wasn't too much of an outsider, that I could somehow enter. So first I got the security that I could do that. Then I got this wonderful email from Ray Brown Jr., and we met early on.
Lovely.
And then I had the luck to encounter all the digitized Black newspapers and all the new material that was out there. So I could feel somewhat more so that I was on more solid ground trying to understand her life. So finally, I think I signed an academic contract in 2013. I retired at 70 from my job so I could really focus on this because it was taking over everything.
Well, that's the
I
thing. So
was
you.
supposed to be teaching and I was not really thinking about anything but Ella. And also, she took over. What I really loved was that I wasn't just living in America in Trump land. I had Ella's life to think about. Even now, I feel grateful that I was living during Franklin Roosevelt and the rise of jazz as a discipline and changes in the civil rights world, and then later feminism. I was living in an alternative universe, as well as living as an American in the rise of the right wing in America. So in a way, I benefited so hugely from living in that double world that most biographers live in. You're always relating everything to your subject. So that's a long answer to a powerful question. I'd say 10 years, 10 years of solid nothing but Ella.
Because I can't, I mean, the joy that you must, I mean, I can, and I can, I know, and listeners
Yes.
can't see, but just the thought of kind of spending that amount of time just completely in Ella, in kind of all of her music. I mean, that must have been such a joy.
Salvation, I would call it salvation, joy. It still is. You know, there was a reporter in Puerto Rico, a female reporter, who said, Ella teaches us how to live when she's on stage. And I think her understanding of the power of music and her mission around her gift to reach as many people as possible and to use music for that old phrase, social harmony, that had a tremendous impact on my life. It made me even speak, I suppose, boldly today about the notion of challenging the backyard that singers like Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday and even Be and Bessie Smith are put into in the jazz narrative. There are textbooks who explicitly say we're excluding vocal jazz. They cannot, and now there's a new generation of both male and female scholars who are revisioning that history, and I'm part of that. I'm part of a revisionist interpretation that's more holistic around this whole phenomenon of vocal jazz and vocal jazz pop and hybridity that jazz is so much a part of and that American culture sponsors and supports as well. You
And
know,
it, no, sorry, go on.
okay, well, I was talking to another, and I didn't. Beyoncé has a hit now on the country music chart.
Oh, yes, it's been causing quite the
I haven't. I haven't really entered into that. But
controversy.
just the fact that here we are with a boundary crossing artist, I
Yes.
haven't heard it, so I can't yet. So I can't comment on it. But there it is.
Yeah.
But
Yeah,
of
no,
course,
that.
Beyoncé isn't a jazz singer, but she's coming out of African American traditions of improvisation and boundary crossing.
Well, it is, and that's the story, isn't it? And the outrage, and again, we could explore that, but perhaps we'll talk again once we've once you've listened to it, and I need to do a bit of research. But yeah, the controversy is how dare she sing a country song? I mean, that's basically it. That's what people are, well, the people who obviously don't understand, but that's the controversy, is that this kind of fantastic black artist is singing a country song. How dare she? I mean, that's what's been. I mean, it's ridiculous, but and I think that's what's also empowering though about telling Ella's story and the way that you do it, that you know, even when you hear of all these incredible women and the battles they were fighting years and years ago, scarily, a lot of these battles are still relevant now. Now, you mentioned Trump, and I won't go there because we could,
Please don't.
I would very happily discuss that, but I think that my point is a lot of the things that you're exploring, Ella's challenges, are still relevant today. So even though this is
Yes.
a story, if you like, that starts, well, many, many years ago, sadly, but importantly, which is, you know, you sharing the story why it's important, these issues are still relevant now. So, you know, it's still a kind of a refreshing story in some ways, if that makes sense.
She managed to do it without being ideological. She did not have. She wasn't ideas first, music second. We have ideas about what music should be, so this is what we'll. No, she was the reverse. This is music. This is what I want to do with it. I'll take as an example Marvin Gaye's song, What's Going On.
Yes.
It's a wonderful song, and it
Yes.
has mixed media in it. And he wrote it as a protest song. Actually, I think he was living in Berkeley at the time, California, where I was trained in part of my career, which had a big impact on me also. And it was a civil rights song in a lot of ways. And when Ella Fitzgerald sang it in 1972 at a wonderful concert, Jazz at the Philharmonic at the Civic
Yeah, see,
Center.
I didn't know she said until I read your book, I didn't realize that she'd sung that song.
Yes, and she sang it on Johnny Carson's show. She took that wonderful sonic exploration that they did for that recording of the background voices and this wonderful texture, and she translated it to improvisation. And someone said to her, "Well, why are you doing a protest song?" And this is in print somewhere. I think I might have cited it, hopefully. She said, "It's good music."
Yeah, yes.
To me, it's not a protest song, meaning that's not the first point. It's good music.
Yeah.
And she wanted that. That was the criterion for that choice. Other times she'd take a commercial from a sitcom, which she wouldn't claim was good music, and go with it and make it a playground. But in this case, she was quite explicit, and it's a wonderful piece of music, and she understood that and championed it that way. So I like that because that really is how most artists think, if I may be so bold. It's not what the prescriptions are telling you to tell people what to do, it's what you experience.
Yeah. And I would challenge anyone to hear Ella and not feel Well, so many emotions. But I think of all the different artists, Ella just had, I mean, magical powers to connect with you. That didn't she? I mean, irrelevant of kind of what stage of her career,
Yes, right.
you
It
know,
was the
she
voice.
connected. Yeah, it was the voice ultimately, whatever she was singing, the way she
Yes.
could connect. And again, with your book, what is you know, wonderful is it's again, I'm going to say many of us know, but it's again reminding people of her technical expertise and power and manipulation of a song, that she's not just a singer. And you touched on this earlier on about, and again, that could be another conversation about, you know, jazz singers are quite often, you know, put in a different category to instrumentalists,
Yes,
you know, often. And I have many,
marginalized.
yeah, many conversations about this. But Ella was ultimately almost the first, arguably, instrumental vocalist, you know, that you know, she used her voice at, you know, and obviously with her scatting and improv. And your book reminds everybody that in no way, shape, or form would you describe Ella as just a jazz singer.
And you also wouldn't describe her voice as an instrumental voice only, because the warmth of the voice, the deep richness and comfort that that voice brings. Also, I had to come pivoting away from your point, but I think being described as just a, there is no just a jazz
Exactly,
singer.
yes.
There is no just a jazz saxophonist. Oh, he's just another jazz guitarist. No, it's one by one by one by one what they do with their instrument. So with Ella, her gift was so great, just the sheer sonic beauty of her voice, when she was such, well, there were metaphors all through her life about how beautiful her voice was, whether it was very early on, peach fuzz. That
Yes.
was one. The innocence and youthfulness and mellow sound of ripe fruit, you know. Or also later on, there was flowing gold. Her voice flowed like gold. She had, you could have a library of metaphors and analogies used to describe Ella's voice. Sometimes that was taken as a lack of authenticity, because somehow it was too beautiful for some people. But it was the kind of beauty that she held in her voice that was also magical. It somehow had hope in it all the time.
And you know, and this may be a little bit out here, but you know, I'm going to say it, and I know our listeners can't see you, but for me, the thought of spending, what are we saying, it was roughly 10 years, I think, of you spending all that time with Ella and her beauty and her joy,
Yes.
that certainly I, and I know I'm not alone, when you hear her, that translates, and it's kind of, it's infectious, isn't it? When you listen to Ella, there's some of her songs and you go,
Yes.
I see that in you. Like when you're
Oh,
talking
thank you.
about Ella, there's a joy and a beauty and a lightness that I can
Oh,
see in you
thank you.
talking about Ella. And it's like the power of Ella
Yes.
and spending all that time with her. It doesn't kind of surprise me that, you know, it's part of you.
I became a pupil.
Yes,
Well,
absolutely.
you know, a lot of jazz musicians in her generation had that gift of living in the present, being able to separate themselves somewhat from the way they, the dominant culture, white people in different ways were treating them. And that's a strength when you can focus on the positive elements in your life and what you're contributing, and not wallow in. Well, Eleanor Roosevelt said this. She said, the best cure for depression is action.
Yes.
The best cure for a sense of, for social justice is doing something.
Yes. Yes.
So, yeah, so that's Ella Fitzgerald. I will tell you at the very end, I really couldn't, I was just completely immersed. I bought from Amazon a yellow tape sticker that said, crime scene, do not cross. And I put it on my study drawer, a
Oh
door.
wow, really? I love that.
Yes. Do not cross. Do not open this door. I will come out when I am ready to enter the present. Other than
Love
that,
that.
believe me, just be warned.
Yes, I love that. I really do. And tell me, and I know we could talk for ages, so I need to be aware of that.
Yes.
But with so much information, I'm imagining you could easily have written a volume one and a volume two, and it could have escalated. How did you find being able to keep it reasonably concise with the amount you probably wanted to say and you probably wanted to explore and could easily have, as I say, gone into probably two, three, four volumes. How
Any
did
more
you,
things? Yes, more
how did you,
musical exams. Well, it's a trade book. It's a trade book, not a university press book. So I knew that I would lose my. Well, let me answer very briefly. The name of my editor at Norton, Tom Mayer. He held the winning card. I will not read this if you go on and on. Why must you say this five times? Why don't you make the main point the head of the paragraph? You're not Soc. This is paraphrasing. You're not Socrates. We're not doing inductive reasoning here. Tell the reader, tell the reader, tell the reader, explain to the reader. I heard that. This is my first trade book over after eight books. So I had a very strong editorial hand guiding me and pushing me,
I hear that quite often,
sometimes
the
shoving me.
importance of the editor, because many people I speak
Shoving me or
to,
pushing me around.
but that's really important, because I say sometimes,
Yes.
especially with when it's an artist's life, you're really kind of getting so involved. And I'm not an author, so I've never written, but I imagine that there would be just be so much you wanted to say, but you can't say it all, and it would be really quite hard to be objective. But yes, the power of an editor to come in and ask those questions is significant. So yes, well, that answers that question then, because yeah, I imagine you could have written books and books and books about Ella quite
I
happily.
just had to learn to be better at concise descriptions. Well, we don't have. I feel a little uncomfortable because I when you bring this up, I think of the mistakes I made in the book and not substituting a few concise paragraphs for what her private life was more about. Or
Oh
I
gosh,
was very
do
criticized by
you? Okay.
a very prominent reviewer for not discussing her involvement with beauty and glamour. I did put those details in, but if I were rewriting the book, I would probably have made it more accessible for in a section where the reader could see the whole chain of being in those details. I left them in the lurch. You know, when you put in detail, there should be connections made. And I left some of those details hanging as loose ends, expecting the reader maybe to make the connections, but I needed to do more of the connection. I needed to connect those dots more myself. It wouldn't have taken that much, but whatever.
Well, it does. I from my point of view, I can certainly tell you there's nothing. I didn't notice any mistakes at all, and I didn't have any unnecessary questions at all. As you say, reviewers, you know. But honestly, it really is a wonderful book. And I would love to have you on another time, actually, because I know you've written other books. And so I've only read this one, and I really would love to spend some time exploring some of your other work. And you mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt, and obviously with your feminist studies. So I do feel I would love to have you on another time. And there's many different things we could
Well, Peggy
explore.
Seeger is right down there in Oxford. You know, Peggy Seeger
Yes.
lives in Oxford, and Peggy has a lot to say about her mother, whose biography I wrote,
Yes.
and about activism in that world.
Yes, I would honestly love to have you on as a guest. There's much we could explore. But I think what to end, I think one question, because everyone knows Ella. So whereas if this was someone that maybe readers didn't know, you might say, well, what do you think they need to kind of what would they learn about Ella? But everyone knows Ella. So I would say for someone who hasn't yet read your book but loves Ella, what do you think your book brings? What will people who think they know Ella and haven't read your book yet, what do you think your book would bring to a new audience?
A new playlist, because that's what people are telling me. People are telling me they're stopping and they're going to listen. They're stopping and going to listen. And I did do a playlist, a biographical playlist. I could do a biographical playlist. I did one for that's online, and I'm going to do a website to put some biographical playlists online. So that's what I think. They'll get the little push. Go listen to this. Go listen to that.
Yes.
That's what I want.
Oh, no, that's wonderful. And we will happily, if you do get a playlist, do let me know. We will happily share it on our Women in Jazz Media playlist, and we will more than happily share that because that sounds wonderful. Okay, thank you so much for being a guest on our podcast. I
Oh,
will
thank you,
include the
Fiona.
links everywhere and hope everybody rushes out to read such a beautiful book, and reminding us, not that we'd forgotten, but giving us an excuse to spend even more time with Ella.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so
Pleasure.
much.